This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Welcome to a seminar that is billed as covering many, many things. And sort of realistically, I don't think we're going to be able to rattle through everything. So what we thought we would do, in case it's not obvious, I'm Debbie McVitie, and I'm a research and policy officer for postgraduates at the National Union of Students. That means I'm employed by NUS, I'm not a student representative. Paul is a representative, and he shall introduce himself.
Yes, I'm Paul Tobin. I'm doing a full-time master's at the moment at the University of Leeds, but I do my part-time fun stuff with NUS as the postgraduate talk rep in my spare time, as it were, if that's possible.
A fine example of a future leader, I think.
We
can all agree. We've been asked to keep the kind of presentation element of this session down as much as possible, and we thought that was probably quite a good idea, given that you've probably been being talked at very much throughout the day. So what we'd like to do is, broadly speaking, we, as you'll have seen from your delegate packs, we've brought some research that we've done into top postgraduate student finance, which is one of the themes that seems to have been emerging throughout the day. And we do want to talk to you a little bit about that because, you know, we have the floor and we kind of have to. But then after that, what we want to do is get some feedback from you about some of the themes that you know you've been thinking about throughout the day, the kind of preoccupations that you've brought and that might have evolved in your thinking as you've been listening to the presentations. And then we're going to use those themes that are emerging to have discussion groups and have sort of ideas and feedback and thoughts as focused as possible on the student experience. But obviously you're coming from different perspectives. And one of the things that we're very conscious of is that actually there's very, very little information about the top postgraduate student experience, certainly. There's a bit more about the research student experience. So we're really all kind of learning together about the student experience, where the student experience fits in the context of postgraduate degrees and how that can be sort of enhanced and all that kind of stuff. So you know, we should talk about those things. But first I'm going to pass over to Paul, who's going to tell you about some of the amazing research that we've done and that we're very proud of.
Exactly, yes. I'm aware that many of you have ideas fermenting under the surface, hopefully, but while we do have the floor, as Debbie said, it will be fantastic to talk about the postgraduate taught, especially finance issues. So hopefully, in your delegate packs, you all have a little document. It won't have my scribblings on yours, thankfully, but it will be just somewhere in there, just saying NUS postgraduate, with a little picture of me in the corner, unfortunately. That's why I was hitchhiking in Estonia for a little bit of background information there. Those of you on the internet, you can't see, but it's a hell of a picture. But equally, while I'm the person in the picture, research was conducted into June of this year, before I even got the position. So really, Debbie is the mastermind behind most of the work, so she has done very well. But I'm going to be introducing it as the voice of postgraduate taught students at the moment. So in the Brown Review, just a couple of months ago now, we've heard earlier today as well that there's no evidence that postgraduate fees and costs are inhibitive to students engaging in postgraduate courses. Now, you would think that it goes without saying that if someone can't afford to do something, then it's going to deter them from taking part in such a programme. But obviously, you can't exactly survey the entire population of the country who hasn't done a master's to see if they're inhibited from participating in a postgraduate sorts course. So actually getting this evidence is quite the difficult project here. So that's what this particular scheme, the very rationale behind it, was to get as much research as we possibly could. We did not survey the entire population of Britain who didn't do a master's. Instead, we targeted it at people who were doing PGT courses and people who were studying at the moment in June 2010, and see what kind of factors or financial issues they were facing at the time, whether finances were an issue, scholarships, how many people get scholarships, all these kinds of things. So we got over 2,500 people, which, considering this is essay time and yet another survey when it is also survey time, we're definitely very happy with the number of feedback we got. And it was quite, although mainly English-specific, it was well distributed throughout the country and across different kinds of courses as well. So I'll talk to you just a couple of the kind of additional niche points that have arisen throughout the documents. So firstly, two-thirds of respondents were entirely self-funded. This does say a lot potentially about the demographics of people who are able to study in this kind of research. It suggests that people really do need a lot of financial clout behind them. Maybe they're dependent on other people. It's worth bearing in mind that it may be inhibitive to people as a deterrent, but What's also worth bearing in mind is the reason that that's the case is because it's very difficult to get credit or finance. If you are 21, 22, there's career development loans, which I'm very happy about the existence of those, but equally it's worth bearing in mind that you can apply for a certain amount, but you don't necessarily get that entire amount. So a friend of mine applied for £10,000, but only got £8,000. I was in the library on registration day at Leeds, and the girl behind me was crying her eyes out because she told her mum saying, well, I applied for £6,000 for this career development loan. I've only got £3,000. You don't get the amount that you apply for. This isn't made clear. So people really are getting themselves stuck in a loop without the access to funding that they need. Yes, and of those who did get funding, over 70% of these did not receive maintenance costs. So I was aware that before I started my master's course this year that I needed to get funding. There was no kind of family members that were in a position to finance me. And in a way, being a postgrad, that I felt like I was kind of making my own route, but finance had to come from my own scholarships if I was to study it. And I was lucky to get a couple of scholarships that were just for my fees. But yeah, there's still the cost of living on top of that, £7,000, £8,000, £9,000, £10,000 a year, which is another lump sum when, for a lot of people, they've got fees, debts, costs from their undergrad degrees from having paid the top up fees and costs already. So lots of inhibition here as well. So going down to cost of postgraduate study, 40.8%, so two-fifths of respondents said their course is more expensive. This really links into the idea of IAG, information, advice and guidance that we were talking about before. People are making informed decisions. They're saying, yes, it costs this much. I need accommodation and living costs. But then there's more costs hidden inside it as well. There's the books, there's getting to placements they might not be aware of. There's an example of a particular engineering department. The engineering department just is in a different little town just down the road. I mean, it's fantastic, but if you're not aware that you've got to get there and got to get all this equipment, then it's the costs of building and building and building up when people are self-funding and aren't aware of how much debt they're going to get into. So going on, over half the respondents indicated they did not know whether their institution could help with costs of postgraduate students. Again, this links with the idea of funding. We're aware that universities aren't exactly going to be creating scholarships at the moment when they're able to get funding from international embassies or things like that. But when people aren't even aware where to look or are struggling, there's so many different areas of places to try on the internet. You type in postgraduate funding, you get taken all over the place. It feels like it could be a very nice sensation just to be able to say, this is where I go to get funding, this is how I find out about it. But people aren't sure even where to begin that process. And 37.2% of full-time students agreed their financial situation has negatively affected their experience. So you've got people who, yes, they've gone for it, they've got themselves onto a postgraduate course, they're paying for it themselves, but they're also working at the same time. How do you balance this idea of what's basically a whole degree in a single year and also having a job, maintaining all these kind of links, and also getting the developmental skills that I mentioned in the previous talk of leadership and all these other things? I mean, how are you going to get that in there as well when you're just kind of serving pints in the pub or selling pens in W.H. Smith's, as I have been known to do over the years? So it's a very difficult question. Penultimate section now. 60% of respondents said there was a major finance was a major consideration. So already we're seeing here that 60% of people actually are saying this is a kind of a factor in their decision to do a course. And these are the people who've been able to do it, let alone the people who have been put off from doing it in the first place. And of those students who received some form of financial help, just over 50% said that postgraduate study would not have been an option for them without that help. And that's even then with a level of optimism in a way, thinking, well, yes, I've got this scholarship, but would I be able to scrape through? I mean, I've got a scholarship this year. Part of me says, would I be able to scrape through? I'm aware that I'm scraping through just about as it is. I mean, there's only so many baked beans you can have in a week before you get really sick of them. So if people are really scraping through already, then how are you imagining people to do so without any scholarships at all? And this is a heck of a statement finally on this particular section. Over 60% of full-time respondents were concerned about their debt levels to the extent that it affects their quality of life. I mean, this is endemic of life in Britain per se at the moment. We've got a country which is saying, essentially, we're massively in debt. This is what you do. You get in debt. And it becomes also a kind of an aspect of your life. Oh, yes, we're in debt. But in terms of the pressure on people's lives to kind of get a mortgage, start a family, do anything with their lives over the age of... I'm 22 now. I have £20,000 worth of debt. And that's with having a scholarship for a postgraduate course. I mean, how much pressure can you level on one person before they start to buckle under the pressure, before they've even got into the career or workplace? So the final section now, the value of postgraduate study. Survey respondents were more likely to focus on educational benefits rather than economic ones. Now, this is quite an interesting reflection. Potentially, of course, with the respondents that we had, there were more people who were doing academic courses of the vocational in certain cases, but not across the board. But it's worth saying here that people aren't saying, oh, this is an investment in my future, because people are actually saying, I loved university, I learned so much stuff there, I just want to get that education experience again. For me, when I was at Sheffield for my undergraduate, I loved my course, International Relations, but I spent so much time in the union doing societies and sports and that kind of thing that when it came to my master's, I just felt like I wanted a year just to study and get my head in the book and go, right, what on earth is going on here? Let's really get sunk into this. So there's a lot of people who are feeling exactly that way. And 73.3% of respondents agree that the education is worth the investment of time and money. This is fantastic news in a way. It's not 100%, but it's great that people are saying that this is worth investment of time and money. This is when people haven't even finished their courses yet. Therefore, we're not asking them to say, has it been worth it for your career? They're talking about an entirely different issue altogether here. And that's why, for me, education doesn't work as a market at all, because it's not a tangible object where you can say that car is worth £10,000, but that one's worth £9,000. It's going to be a market, you're going to compete, I'm going to buy that car. What's actually happening is you're speculating. This isn't a market, this is a stock market, where you get to say, well, I guess this is going to be a benefit, but unless I do this, this, and this as well, and I'm lucky, and someone else does this, then it might be beneficial. It doesn't work like that, and that's why you can't have a kind of exactly the same market relationship you would do with other aspects of life, per se. So to conclude then, 53.9% agree that their course is good value for money. But we had two interesting open-ended statements here. One was saying that, how can it be good value for money? I spent £4,000 just on a piece of paper, and then accommodation, and then living expenses. That can't possibly be good value for money. And then someone else in the survey said, of course it's value for money. How can I even speculate on the cost of value for money? What does value mean?
It's how dare you even ask if it's value for money?
Yeah.
Yeah,
education is just so valuable. To even suggest it has a value, a kind of a tangible cost, is just ridiculous. How could you possibly ask this? So the understandings of value here are completely skewed in terms of what people are looking to postgraduate study for. So it's vital that we bear some of these in mind, hopefully. So that's a little guide to some of our research. It's very brief, and by our, I mean Debbie's, to be honest.
Well, I know. And I think there's maybe perhaps two things to pull out of this. And I think the first thing is that when you're talking about postgraduate experience, postgraduate support, you're always talking in the context of financial constraints. And I think it's I'm just thinking of it like a needs hierarchy. You know, people need to be fed and they need to sleep. And in an educational context, they need to be kind of confident of their funding. And we're not saying, I mean, we suggested to Lord Brown that the postgraduate or that the student support system should be extended to top postgraduates. Obviously, that didn't fly. And we're really not suggesting that, you know, scholarships should be created and everyone should do it for free. We're pointing out that if you don't even have access to credit, then that's, you just can't get into the course. But also that, you know, for part-time students, it's not perhaps even paying for the course. It's more, you know, balancing the course with other issues. You're always kind of constrained at the postgraduate level, I think, by your financial situation. And that's something to reflect on. But the other thing that came out of our questions about value, and we actually, we sort of probably agree with the person who said, how dare you ask that question, because we don't, as an organisation, broadly speaking, believe that it's about the kind of consumer benefit of education. But there is this kind of narrative of sort of marketing postgraduate courses, and I realise many of you actually do work in that environment, and I'm not saying don't market, of course not. But that individuals are going in on a very individual basis and saying, you know, what I'm going to do a cost-benefit analysis of undertaking postgraduate study. And I think a big question for us that we're perhaps wrestling with a little bit, especially in the context of potentially much increased fees and potentially maintenance as well, where does things like learning community and student engagement, the kinds of activities actually, you know, the idea of students as partners in the learning process, where does that, the kinds of things that develop the kinds of leadership skills that David Doherty was talking about, where does that fit in? How do these narratives fit together? And these are sort of two questions, I think, that we kind of will be thinking about on an ongoing basis. Other themes that seem to us to have been coming out throughout the day are to do that you know that you may wish to pick up on. We are about to hand over to you momentarily. Other themes that we've picked up on, obviously there's this employability thing, you know, what happens after the degree, and there's not been an awful lot about information, so it's kind of, yeah, what gets told at the beginning and what happens at the end. So maybe these are things that you want a student perspective on or feel that you want to kind of discuss further. What we're going to do, we're going to hand over to you, and if I think we have a roving mic.
Yes, that's
great. I'm looking at Paul like he knows. So if you've any kind of thoughts or things you want to throw out, or just any kind of questions, and we're going to kind of gather those together and then turn that into more of a kind of discussion forum so you can perhaps share a bit of practice or perhaps go, oh, I don't know, I need more input on this. So, over to you.
Howard, excellent.
But I'll preface what I say by saying I think the Brown report is a complete disaster. And if we put that on one side for a minute and look at the outcomes of it, it seems to me it's going to force us to look differently at postgrad education. Mm. And coming out of today, there still remains a view that postgraduate education is full-time, didactic teaching in a classroom for 30 weeks plus a thesis. And clearly that is neither the kind of thing that the future will allow us to do, but neither is it good teaching. I mean, it's unfortunate that people like Brown are going to force us to do that, but actually it's a crazy way of doing things. And during the course of today, there was a discussion, or I think it was Malcolm who noted that the new universities have picked up a lot more of the postgraduate students than the old, if you like, in terms of the increase. And I'm willing to bet, I've got no evidence at all, but I'm willing to bet they teach in a different way. They're far more flexible. They've adapted to a whole different agenda about postgrad in terms of delivery, in terms of flexibility, in terms of online, in terms of, I could carry on going on. And that really what Brown is doing is giving us a really good kick up the backside and saying, look, you've got to adapt your postgrad work to a completely different pedagogy. Or at least in part do that. That's the first point. And the second one is, we're good old British people. We look at the way we do it in England even, don't we? I mean, we've got this nationality thing running at the moment. But basically, we don't look outside our own backyards to how we do things. And we could learn an enormous amount by looking around the world and seeing it, but how they do things and how they may well do things better. Both in terms of pedagogy and, in terms of all the things I've been talking about. And it seems to me that's the challenge. The thing that I get from looking certainly across Europe is the way in which, I mean, you're quite an interesting example because you did your undergraduate degree in Sheffield and now moved to Leeds. I'd love to know where you actually lived before you moved to Sheffield because...
Peterborough.
Because the model is not to go to your nearest university. But, of course, at postgrad level, that changes completely. And geography becomes very, very important. Mm.
Geography. Well, it's very two-tier, isn't it? Some people go to the prestigious institutions and some, you know, before the prestige of getting a postgraduate degree from that institution, and some people go to their local institution because they want the flexibility.
Yeah, but if you look at the total number of postgrads in the top 20 universities, and it's around, I don't know, it's probably about 50,000. I haven't got the figures down. And then look at the rest... To answer your question, the second tier, the other tier, are geographically constrained. And we really are going to have to address that. That the notion that you can concentrate PGR in the top 20 might hold true, but you can't... Well, I'm actually in favour of that, to be honest, but you can't do that for postgraduate taught. You can actually let geography determine things. But we've really got to adapt to that. And I'm willing to bet we'll be sitting here in 10 years' time thinking, oh, crikey, we've got no more postgrad students. But we won't have altered pedagogy, we won't have altered. And there'll be one or two places who are high-flying. And if I can just finish at one point, because when we run our workshops, we always start with a quiz. Because I think it's always a good idea to get the kind of baseline of knowledge across the audience. It's always done as a warm. But can I just ask everyone to identify the university which has got most postgraduate students in the country? Well, you'll know the answer.
Someone down here?
I would have thought it was the Open University.
Would everyone else agree with that? Absolutely right. What's the next one?
I know this.
Is it Berkshire?
is it Manchester?
Is it?
I'm trying to. I looked at this last year, but I haven't actually looked at it since.
Sorry, it's not a test.
It is a test. We're posting that as a test.
And we're on telly.
But I'm using that as an example because I don't think we have managed to disseminate the way in which postgrad teaching pedagogy courses have developed across UK institutions. I don't think we're all looking inside our own institutions and don't understand how things have moved on. Mm. And I think that's really, you know, that's the kind of thing that really bugs me because we're remaining very introspective. We still talk about teaching and learning. From today, we should be talking about learning and teaching. It's just getting the emphasis the right way around. Anyway,
do people want to pick up any of those points?
We're looking to an audience. We want it to be as interactive as possible. So if you'd like to kind of have a little internal debate, that'd be fantastic as well. We don't want it to be too front-facing.
Yeah, do it like, basically. But
yeah.
Does anyone want to pick up on any of those issues? Or indeed any other issue?
We can just quickly respond to that and then we'll go back to the floor. I mean, first of all, you talked about distance learning and how that's changing. I mean, yes, from Peterborough and then Sheffield and then Leeds. University is seen in a way as kind of, when I was applying for undergrad, it's a rite of passage. You're going to go somewhere else that's nowhere near where I'm from and then work it out from there. Once it came to postgrad, a whole completely different set of issues arises, basically, and that no longer becomes an issue. I've proved myself that I can cook my baked beans day after day after day. I can now survive away from home. The question is, can I afford to do this, basically? But the other question is, where is my course going to be? And the nearest university to mine is University of East Anglia or Anglia Ruskin, really. But neither of them do my particular conflict masters, which I'm doing at the moment, which is focused purely on international development. So, yes, we might have more regionalisation, but unless the courses are kind of matching, and that would potentially suggest expanding course ranges rather than shrinking that we're seeing at the moment. I don't know how the
French. How do they manage?
This is the point I'm trying to make. If you live in North Adderley, you go to the University of Dunkirk, possibly to Picardy, possibly to Amiens, and possibly to Lille.
Do the French have our level of specialisation at top postgrad level?
Yeah.
I don't know how they manage them. We should definitely ask them. Yeah. I think it's probably a learning outcome from that conversation.
But then surely there are the Grands Écoles, too. Oh, yeah. So although they're not called universities, they are, in effect, selected universities.
They are, but they're a small proportion of the total market. That's what I'm trying to get. The vast majority of French young people go to their local university.
And in American, from what I can perceive of a lot of people I've spoken to, at least, I mean, you have your state university, and then you kind of go there. Unless you're going to an Ivy League university, you are going to your state university.
Or else you go to your local community college.
Yes. Yeah.
And then go home.
And build up from
upgrade,
there.
Yeah,
that's true. The other one you said, looking at the rest of the world, this is exactly what we're going to do. We're going to ask Vance. There you go. That's subject when we get back later.
Vance
on
and others, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is something to bring to the European Students Union.
Yes, perhaps. We do have quite close links with them, so that would be a fantastic way of building upon that. That'd be great. Thank you. We want direction as well, and it's to a certain extent here, because there's so much to
go and learn together.
Yes, exactly. Yep. We are as a very new committee. We are within NUS. We've been here for a year and a bit now, so we are hopefully going onwards and upwards, but we'd like to continue that, really. So, did you have a point?
Well, I have a question, which is, there's some interesting statistics in here. If you go to the full report... you've got some interesting statistics in the paper that you present. If you go to the full report, have you tried to analyse that in terms of demographics? You know, how much does it change things if you're an international student? How much does it change things if you're home EU?
We pulled out... We had, reflecting the numbers of postgraduates studying at the Open University, we had a very large response rate from the Open University. So what we then subdivided demographics minus Open University respondents into full-time, part-time, overseas, UK, EU, and also the top-up fee generation, which is UK domiciled under 25. And that was to try and get a sense of how responses would change if for students who had come through top-up fees. And we got some very varying responses. So one of the quite interesting things, which didn't make it onto this very short summary, because it's a 30-page report, lucky old you if you're going to go read it, was that overseas students are much more likely to anticipate enhanced employment outcomes from postgraduate study, more so than the other respondents. So they were sort of 66% versus 50-something percent. And I thought that was a very interesting thing for universities to reflect on, sort of saying, well, how are you pitching to overseas students and what kind of added value are you providing for them? given that they're more likely to think about this in, perhaps in employment terms, or perhaps our particular respondents. It's very hard when it's a self-selecting survey, but it's more of a pool in that respect.
Because I wondered how much the fact that the international postgraduate student fee in many cases is very much higher than the UK student fee had influenced the financial worries aspects of your survey.
It's different in that quite a lot of the international students we seem to be receiving are often funded directly from some of those countries themselves. That was
to some extent. They were certainly as likely as full-time and top-up fee generation to be concerned about debt. Yeah. So you get quite a lot of, I think, as I understand it, people who are perhaps based on loans from their governments, perhaps so they're to be in debt, getting into debt to come and do postgrad study in the UK. Certainly you would have... What were the other things?
They were
the most likely to find that their course was more expensive than they thought it was going to be. So there's a big question there about what advice and guidance is provided to overseas students about expenses associated with living in Britain and whether that's really being kind of done, well, I suppose on a regional basis, actually, as well as perhaps by individual institutions and nationally. I think if you have to go, don't worry, that's fine. We understand people need to go for trains at this point in time. And certainly something coming out of the postgrad review was this kind of idea that we need to be thinking about marketing the UK postgraduate experience internationally, but that along with that comes an awful lot of burden to provide information to overseas students about what they're actually getting into, because you do get people. And there is, we work quite closely with our international student campaign in NUS, and the word that we hear most often is cash cow. And it's a stereotype, absolutely, but it's a perception among international students that they are a source of income for their institutions. And we know that at postgraduate taught level, a lot of postgraduate courses would just collapse if there were no international students in them. So how you communicate the value of having international students in the institution and what they're getting for their money, it's a horrible thing to say. But
that's obviously going to change with the fees increasing post-grad. I think the whole package and that sort of concept will change, won't it?
But again, that's a problem which is about presentation, isn't it? Because actually the postgrad fee change, the postgrad overseas fee is no more when added to what the funding council will say. As
in many cases, yeah.
Well, the whole thing arose by Thatcher saying that postgrad students should pay the full fee, which is the funding council fee plus the fee. Mm-hmm. The problem is, you don't explain that to them.
Yeah.
But we're actually getting no more money in aggregate.
Oh, sure, under no impression. And I think
that's the problem. But the other thing which we've been doing some work recently on exchange rate fluctuation, and actually, a lot of overseas postgraduate students, the fee in the UK has gone down 25-30% over the last 24 months, the pound has gone down. And the dynamics of that are worth explaining to students as well. It's back to information and to get away from some of the stereotypical perceptions of what the UK is doing.
Yeah, and I think, and maybe contradict me here, because I mean, maybe this may not be true, but I think because individual institutions are marketing and recruiting to overseas students, perhaps, that there isn't this kind of shared narrative of international overseas students studying in the UK at postgrad level that is, sort of a positive picture. People may be doing this at the institutional level, but they're not perhaps doing it collectively. Maybe that's, yeah.
Is that entirely true? Sometimes, as I've been an international officer, but what used to be the British Council's Educational Counselling Service, I think is now Education UK Partnership? Yes, exactly. Do they not do this? My impression is that is a large part of their function, to sell the UK as a brand. And they may not do it well. I mean, I'm not sure.
I don't know. I mean, I'm really just throwing out the question for discussion. But
it would be worthwhile. They've just been trying to have their conference in Edinburgh and failing because of the snow. But it might be worthwhile asking them as an organisation, because they should at least be able to give a view of what they say they're trying to do. It'd be interesting to measure reality against that.
I wonder to what extent there's a distinction as well between the undergraduate international and the postgraduate international, and whether they need to be pitched at different levels. Speaking from a position of really quite a lot of ignorance here, and again, feel free to correct me, I would get a sense that when people are talking about international students, they talk about them en masse, and there's less effort perhaps to distinguish between different levels and different types and different contexts. And it's going to vary, but that may be kind of an element of something that needs to be looked at, perhaps.
Interesting that one of the issues we find with the committee is that 50% of postgraduate taught students are international. It's around that, isn't it?
It's a lot.
And so we're finding that postgraduate taught students are as heterogeneous as international students. So the postgraduate taught students are part-time, full-time, have children, mature, distance learners, all these kind of things. But the postgraduates and what they expect are just as different. And what's more, they fit into the difficult categories, as it were, of the postgraduate taught students as well. And so the postgraduate taught international student is pretty much our kind of epitome of person we're trying to get our heads around this year. Thankfully, two of our committee members are international students, and it's becoming quite a priority of our campaign. But there's a lot of very difficult kind of issues here that we need to really start to address if we're going to actually make sure these people are... Because one of the four topics here is retention that we're speaking about. Making sure that these people see that they're getting value for money, as it were, and stay as part of the course. And we are excellent in a way at kind of creating this brand of Britain PLC, as it were, and getting people wanting to come to Britain. But are we explaining to them the context that they're coming to Britain in? And like you were saying about the funding that they're paying, the cost of their courses that they're paying, are they understanding the kind of causality behind that and why this has arisen, so that they feel like they are getting a better value for money and they are feeling that more they're part of the process, really? Which I don't think we are necessarily. I think that'd be a good way for moving forward then.
An awful lot of build and momentum around creating an undergraduate community, and that's what we sell overseas and that's what we sell to the students here, but we don't seem to sort of reflect that in the postgraduate marketplace at all. And I just wondered how you feel about being a postgraduate student and whether that was something that you bought into or that you've developed yourself with the networks that you have.
Brilliant question. And this is kind of exemplified by a referendum at Leeds Union just a couple of weeks ago, which was, should the union have its own postgraduate lounge, basically, where postgraduates could go by themselves. Now, I ended up voting against this, completely to the confusion of the officers at the union, because I want us to have a community that we create ourselves, but when it comes to a union, which is supposed to represent all students, we didn't want to be separated either. So, bloody postgrads, you want to have your own community, and then you don't want to be separated either. So, what often we've found is that postgraduates within departments within the university are good at creating their own little small networks within the course, say, perhaps, or our Thursday pub quiz sessions, where about 25 of us go and answer pub quizzes and always come second, is the kind of community that we've established. But then we also like to feel like, in a way, especially students like me who have... This is completely different, again, for more mature students, but for people who've just left their undergrad degrees, they want to feel like, in a way, they're still part of the same student community as well. Not a particular postgrad community, but a student community as well. And so I think a lot of postgrads want to have that availability of both worlds in a strange way. So, yes, I do feel part of a community. It's one that I've created with our postgrads. But I feel also part of the old kind of student community. But I don't think that's the case for a lot of mature students.
Can you see the challenge? I work in marketing. And can you see the challenge around, obviously, trying to market the notion of a postgraduate community when you're talking about doing it from a distance and when these things are quite bespoke and they're around a particular course, and we're talking about an institution that has, 220 postgraduate courses across a number of different schools and an international marketplace, talking to different people from different cultures with different expectations. And it's about how we are able to position ourselves within that, utilising, obviously, the students that we do have and our alumni to kind of create that as a brand external to the institution. And it's just kind of trying to pinpoint that and understand how we can actually network within that and actually get that message across, that one of the value for monies you're getting is that you're going to be part of a postgraduate community and here's what it involves. Yeah. And that's very tricky.
Yes, well, marketing it is definitely the first step. Also, we're going to go on to it later on. It's up to you guys if we do, but we are, I'm aware, running out of later on. The idea of student representation and engagement as well. So it's one thing to kind of talk about it being there. It's also the issue of saying, well, come on, guys, vote in the elections, be part of these societies. We've got this community that is essentially accessible to you. It's mainly undergraduate, but still available. So from what I'd say in terms of marketing, I would just refer to the idea of it's the best of both worlds is how I kind of feel about being a postgrad who's just left my undergrad course. I'm aware that if I had two small children, lived 2 hours away, and was working full-time as well at the same time, I'd be saying a very different kind of message about the experience. But again, they're looking to a postgraduate course for very different reasons as well, I think.
It's a bit problematic, isn't it? I mean, because especially the whole kind of market narrative depends on individual choices and things that are bespoke, you know, like you say, bespoke and tailored for your, you know, for your individual self. And I think Paul's right to kind of flag up student-led stuff. So systems of representation, course representation, ideas about learning from peers and building in kind of peer assessment and peer learning into courses, because that's a really important way to learn, and it builds independence. You know, you've got to kind of create a culture in which community is a default. It's part of the learning, I suppose, as best you can. But that's really, really challenging, because people are coming from a distance and they're coming from lots of different contexts, and they've got a lot else to do other than be part of a lovely community. So I really, like, absolutely see the challenges there. But I think, yeah, I think it's got to come from the bottom up, actually. I think the most institutions can do is create a culture in which community could flourish, and then kind of kick enough students to try and make it happen. And there's some quite interesting examples of sort of online forums and that kind. And one of the things we're looking at in NUS at the minute is this idea of student-led initiatives or researcher-led initiatives as a kind of way of skills training, of developing experiences rather than kind of sitting people in a room and talking at them. So we're saying, well, run your own stuff, build your own communities this way. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I think it's something that people are going to have to start thinking about quite a lot. And sort of articulating kind of exactly what it means to be part of a student community at the postgraduate level, because it's not just a sort of nice thing that you get to have when you're studying at postgraduate level. It's also a really important way of learning. And if it's not there, then I think that your experience is probably going to be impoverished. That probably doesn't answer the question at all, does it? But sort of just talk around it a bit.
It's a big issue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Did you have a question as well?
I mean, that's what we end up doing. We end up segmenting to such a level that obviously resourcing then becomes the issue that we have with that. Not so much what we do with that information. I think we know who's out there and potentially what they're doing, and we realise that it has to be segmented to that kind of a level. And then it's just about how we service that and how we create value added around those messages to those subsets of students. And I think sometimes they're quite hard to reach.
The Open University does some really interesting stuff here, because of course it's all distance learning, or for the most, 95% of it, and everything they do, they have a very kind of active online community, and they've got forums on different topics and by geographical regions, and if you want to sort of start up a forum saying Open University students who like cats and live in East Anglia, then you can do that, and I think perhaps those are the kinds of places we might look to think about engaging distance learners and that kind of thing as well. Sort of, you can overestimate, I think, the value of things like Facebook and social networking, but...
A quick thing on the OU is just a question of, is it because they're all doing it very well, or is it because the people who want to be part of that explicit online external community are going to the OU because they know they're going to get it there, because they're that kind of person, they know they participate in it? Because I'd rather just see the person in person, that's why I'm doing university on site, as it were, and doing my master's on site. But if you're the kind of person who wants to do a distance learning thing where you engage with people online, then you're going to go to the OU, and that's why it flourishes, perhaps. I don't know. Also, they obviously have some good mechanisms as well, but it's a difficult cause and effect kind of question, I think, sometimes. Did you have a question?
Yeah, yes. You were mentioning retention and students getting what they expected. What do they expect?
Well, the answer to that question is... this is kind of what I tried to allude to at the start, is that it's this interesting paradox where you kind of expect that a lot of postgraduate students, and it's true for certain vocations and courses, that they're saying this is an investment in a way, this is what's going to enable me to get that job as a social worker, as a nurse, or it's going to mean that when I get that job I'm going to be promoted more quickly. It's that kind of investment idea. So that there's that whole kettle of fish that definitely do exist, that's undeniable. There's also the idea that, for me, I just wanted to learn more about this international development idea and see how different communities interact in Southeast Asia. That was my particular desire, and it's a very different... talking about marketing, you've got completely polarised target audiences there if you're going to try and hit both of those, and that's one of the difficulties we're kind of seeing, because how are you going to get value if you're, if the people you're trying to aim towards are expecting completely different things. And also, if they're on the course at the time, how do they know if they're getting value for money? You can't ask them, in a way, if they're getting value for money to a certain extent. If they're there to get an investment for the future, and the future's not happened yet, it's still the present, as it were. So, yes, I share your rhetorical point.
No, it's just interesting, because I think the value for money angle we're seeing much more in the sort of sense of literal value for money. You know, there is a three-hour lecture schedule, we only use 2 hours, what am I paying for?
Yes.
Sort of argument. And there seems to be a distinction, or not a distinction made, between teaching and learning.
Yeah.
And there seem to be, some of them are looking for more teaching, more obvious, standing up, I'm getting something here, than, oh, I'm back to do it myself, but what am I paying for that for?
Yeah.
And the notion of actually learning doesn't always seem to be getting through.
And I would, if I was in marketing, say, which I know lots of you are, I'd try and hammer home this idea very early on, because people want to get value, and it's difficult because you want to say, oh, it's fantastic, you get lots of contact time, which is a lot too in a lot of courses, but also down the line, when that starts being the case, people start to say, wait a minute, what the hell am I paying for? Because the idea early on was that you're paying pro rata, as it were. And I remember in third year, this being part of a conversation with people working out how much it costs per hour for their degree, and therefore, oh, God, that's £100 in that seminar.
That.
Yeah, but that is the conversation that people have had. And as much as you try and to get around that, then this is an idea that people have got in their heads, unfortunately.
I think also with expectations, there's always this kind of rather tricky thing, because I think there are things that students have a right to expect, and that that's kind of clear, accessible information that that is accurate and ideally sort of independently provided, and a certain level, certain standards of quality. And of course, we talk about being able to kind of the UK brand needs to be sort of protected, and people need to know that they're going to get good teaching, and access to the resources that are going to suit their course. There are certain things that people should expect. But also, education doesn't work like that. You don't kind of go and say, well, I expect the following, and therefore it shall be delivered to me, and thank you, I shall also have a pass. It's so much... arguably, the entire educational process is about the management of expectations. What you think you're going to go in to find out quite often turns out to be not what you end up learning. And that conversation...
came in, but failed, and said, you come to an English university and you expect to get your degree...
So you don't.
You sort of have to pass.
Yeah.
I don't think we should brush this on one side, because there are some base expectations, which it's very... I mean, I take your point about obviously students expect in the past, but there are some basic expectations, which... I mean, I've spent most of my life as an academic, and I would be on the student's side. It isn't trivial.
No?
It's not even financial. It's about a relationship between a student and a member of staff, and it's about... It's about the value that either of those two people put on each other's work. And if a member of staff doesn't turn up on time, then I think that's not on. Equally, I would say to a student, if you don't turn up or you don't deliver your essay, then that's tricky. But it's all too easy to brush all that on one side, because this is academia. It's different. We're universities. We're not Tesco's. Well, actually, I think it would be a good idea if someone, from Tesco came and worked with some of these universities, just to find out how you get to a level of customer service and can deliver happy customers. I mean, and by saying happy, I'm not trivializing at all. There is a real need to grasp that. And if we're moving into a competitive world and a market-led world, which is what we have been in the past, actually, though it's just become more and more explicit, we'll have to get sorted out on some of these things. So you might think it's banal talking about value in terms of people turning up on time. I think it's fundamental. I think that's simply the bottom line. Everything else of value builds on top of that. If you can't expect that...
if you could go first, I've got your name, and then we'll...
I just wanted to say that's absolutely right, but I think this idea of the student as customer, the instrumental motivation, a little bit of a red herring, and particularly in service, to use the marketing jargon, the product is co-created between the provider and the consumer. I mean, look at something like the way medicine is now delivered. It's about the partnership between the doctor and the patient. The gym membership analogy has been used, and I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, and you see all these sort of green letters to the Times Higher from academics, shock horror, this idea of consumer as students. But in the MBA world, students are very premium fees and being expected to participate, and they are part of the product, and haven't necessarily expected to collect their distinction at the door. I think we're almost creating a problem where it isn't there. Some of it is definitely about managing expectations and, crucially, picking the right students or giving out the right information to get students to select themselves out in the first place.
But I think the key point, when people talk about managing expectations, I think, and certainly when I talk about it, it's not, you're not saying lower expectations, you're not saying don't tell people that, it's about saying, well, actually, perhaps let's have a conversation about what you expect and what we expect to deliver. Let's try and bring those two things closer together. And I certainly would know, I would certainly never think that it was a trivial question at all. But I believe we have
to wrap up. Yeah, I've seen that we're wrapping up, unfortunately. Our email address, for NUS purposes, and should you want to be in touch, because we'd love it, to be honest, if you were, is just on here, right at the bottom right-hand corner, postgraduates@nus.org.uk. Exactly what you'd expect it to be, thankfully.
And not picked up by either or both of us.
Yeah, we'd love to help you. But thank you very much for coming on to at the end of the day. It really was appreciated. So, thank you.
Thank you.